All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. I'll give you a quick heads up, and then we're going to get started here. We're going to do the first hour is the Power Hour questions for Pittsburgh Power. And then we'll do a second hour of general questions, tax, fuel mileage, health, whatever you want to talk about in the second hour, anything goes. First hour is going to be Pittsburgh Power. And I will tell you right now, both calls and questions are really heavy today, early. So if you want a chance to get in, you better press one on your phone pretty quick because it's starting to fill up. So whether you've got a question, a comment, a topic for the first hour or the second, press one on your phone right now. If it's a general question, we'll screen the call and hold you till the second hour. And we're going to get started. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it, we'll talk about it. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call on the air. Today is the Power Hour. And I'm not going to do an open. We're going to jump right into phone calls. Bruce and John and Leroy, all from Pittsburgh Power, are joining me to help out. So, Bruce, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Kevin. We just got returned home last night from the owner-operator snowmobile conference. We had 27 people, six new owner-operators that never rode snowmobiles in the mountains, and they thoroughly enjoyed themselves. It was a wonderful time.
Well, I bet they did. That sounds like a lot of fun, and maybe we'll talk about that. Let's bring John and Leroy on. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
Hey there. Good, good. So we've got lots of questions on the line. Anything that you guys want to start with?
I just want to mention that about 3 years ago, we bought a hoist to pick trucks up so we could do the transmissions and clutches and drive shaft work easier and keep our mechanics off their knees. But it failed. It had some engineering glitches in it, and for the past year we haven't been able to use it. So finally we got to working and re-engineering it and went to cog wheels and cog belts instead of V-belts and simplified the electronics on it, and so it's working perfect. So we're back in the transmission, clutch, and drive shaft business. And I also wanted to mention that we talked about that 10,000 sticker head gasket for the D-Deck 4 Detroit 3 and 4. We used the first one this past week, making no other changes other than replacing the block and the crank in this engine, reusing his liners and pistons and ECM and turbo and manifold. We gained 27 horsepower to the rear wheels.
Wow.
Now, the head gasket is actually 12,000 thicker instead of 10, which is even better. John will tell you more about it. It's made by a company that made head gaskets for them for race cars. It's a beautiful gasket, and he's going to talk to you about the angle of the camshaft and the gears in the front and what this does after you resurface the block on it. 12.7, how we bring it back to the factory piston-to-deck height with this thicker gasket. John?
Yeah, we had an opportunity with a customer who was on a tight budget to use a block that we thought was out of spec, so we milled it about 5,000ths below the recommended minimum and used our 12,000ths thicker gasket on it. And I personally wasn't sure what the results would be or how well it would work. And, you know, I'd done some calculations, and we figured we pulled about 0.3 of a point of compression out of it for from where it would have been with a stock gasket. So we're probably somewhere right around stock or a touch under after putting the gasket on. But I think the big gain came in the gear train geometry in the front of the engine. If you look at the way those gears are laid out, when you move that head down at all, you really rotate the camshaft quite a bit. And Detroit doesn't reference that with the computer, so you're not going to throw a code or anything. So really the computer doesn't even know where the camshaft is. So it could be, you know, depending on how the thing has been decked or, you know, the way the head was originally machined or had been remachined, if it's a reman head, you change that timing quite a bit. And this engine ended up being exceptionally smooth and quiet as well after we put the taller gasket in. And we, you know, put one of our standard programs that normally makes about 550 rear wheel horsepower to the engine, and rolled the thing on the dyno and broke it in, and then we gave it a run on the dyno, and the thing made 577 without, you know, without doing anything but one of our standard 550 horsepower programs. So I'm sure we could attribute a good bit of that to the gasket.
Yeah. That's
and
fantastic.
What I couldn't get over was how much it quieted up the front of the engine. I thought that's, you know, the gears are pretty fussy about angles and so forth, and with that idler where it's placed, I think that the height of the cam is a very big deal here.
That's interesting. I've got a question for you. Let's say that, you know, you said if you bring that deck height down and it throws the angle of the gears off and the computer doesn't see that at all, but it has pretty far-reaching effects in the engine. If an engine were built that way, rebuilt that way, that it seems to me like that could have an effect on fuel economy, and it could be one of those engines that we just can't seem to diagnose why it gets bad fuel economy. Could that be part of it?
Kevin, think about this.
Okay, one sec. Whenever you decrease the compression ratio, you increase the volumetric efficiency. By us doing that and gaining that 27 horsepower on a 13 or an 18-speed transmission, that truck will now go up the grades or the hills one-half gear higher. So he has enough power with the same amount of fuel to run 3 to 4 mile per hour faster, which will equate to fuel mileage, better fuel mileage. Go ahead, John.
Interesting.
Well, I've noticed, and you know, being a set of eyes from the outside, or you know, coming back to the industry after some time off, and the Detroit Series 60 is something I don't have much experience with at all. I've always been a Cummins guy. I mean, from my roots with Bruce, we were a Cummins shop back then, and I've always loved the things. But so being detached for a while and then coming back at it, I've learned a few things and observed some things that maybe some of you have gotten used to. And one of the things I've noticed about these Detroits is they don't seem consistent. We've got some that just smoke for no good reason, you know, no matter what program we put in or what injector's in there. And then there are some other, you know, little things that I just noticed. Some are rougher than others. Some are quieter than others. And as I studied this front, the geometry, this gear train geometry, after we did this deal with the gasket, and one of my worries was that we'd get too far away, which is not at all a possibility. I think that some of those inconsistencies could come from that. A reman head, or all the reman heads exactly the same thickness, you know. And what happens with this thing, the cam is fixed to the gear. There's no offset key we could put in there, anything we'd really do to change it. Nor is there any way to measure it or check it. You know, a Cummins, an ISX, the cams are infinitely adjustable. So you put all the gear train on, and then the cam gears are held on with a slight taper, and you lock the cams in place, and you put the thing atop dead center, and you lock them down, and the cams are always going to be in the same relationship to the crankshaft. But one thing I've noticed about the Detroit is it could be anywhere, and there's no way to really check it, nor does the computer watch it. You know, the computer looks at the gear that drives the air compressor for some reason and the crank. So that's just some things, you know, some observations from the outside. But I think that using the scientific method here, we may have come into something that makes a difference with these engines and might make them more consistent.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I started running Detroits back in the early 90s, 1990 actually, got my first one. And all through the 90s and early 2000s, I thought they were very consistent engines in that fuel economy was always good, maintenance costs were low, they lasted a long time. But then in the last 7 or 8 years that we've been doing a lot of rebuilds, trying to keep these things running and keep them alive, and all the gliders being built with the Series 60, we started to run into these same inconsistencies, and it was really frustrating, because I had said for years, bring me a Detroit that's not getting good fuel economy, we'll figure out why. And we started running into some that we just couldn't seem to figure out. And like you said, there was just a lot of inconsistencies. And this may explain it.
I think it definitely can.
Well, that's certainly good to know, because, boy, I was frustrated. You know, we had gliders that, you know, on paper should have been doing 7.5 miles to the gallon, and they were doing 5.5. We're six and struggling, and, you know, we were just kind of baffled by some of them. So it's good to know that this could be the problem on the Series 60, and based on the way you guys are building the engines, you know how to avoid that problem.
Kevin, it might be interesting to take one of those low fuel mileage Detroits and do nothing else other than put our 12,000 sticker head gasket on it and see if that doesn't cure the problem.
That would be interesting. Now, the two of them that I was working with were so bad, and, you know, in the beginning, the shop in Detroit kept saying, well, that's just the way it is, it's just normal, and I kept telling these guys, it's not normal. Something is wrong with that truck. We've checked everything we can think of, and it was bad enough that Detroit replaced both engines. They finally said, we don't know what it is either. We're just going to put another engine in it. So if I run into another one, though, I am certainly going to recommend that, because I think that would be interesting. All right, well, we blew through the first segment, so let's get to a break. And when we come back, we'll start taking some phone calls. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. It is the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, Bruce and Leroy and John. And, guys, we've got a lot of questions lined up. What do you say we tackle some? Do it.
Okay.
Let's get to it. Let's start off in Texas. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. What I'm asking about is I've got a 6N Z-Cat, 355 rear end, low rubber, 18 speed. 330-inch wheelbase, and I'm thinking about switching it to a 13-speed. There's two Micro Blue transmissions in Texas. One's an 18-speed, one's a 13-speed. I could buy either one I want. What would be my best option? I'd save $1,000 if I went with the 13-speed. And then my second question would be... Go ahead.
Let me jump
you
in.
You currently have a 10-speed?
I'm sorry, sir?
Do you currently have a 10-speed?
No, I currently have an 18-speed.
Okay. If I were you, I'd stay with the 18-speed then. I would buy the 18.
Right. And then would it benefit me to have it,
well,
to buy a micro-blued one or bring it to Pittsburgh Power and let you guys do it?
Before we get there, let me ask you this. You've already got an 18-speed. How many times in the last month have you split a gear in the bottom end?
I haven't split a gear in the bottom end in a year. I'm never heavy enough.
Yeah.
You know, I do household goods and enclosed. I'm never heavy enough, really, in my mind, to split a bottom gear. That's why I was thinking the 13-speed.
You know, kind of what I'm thinking. Most guys that run these at 80,000 pounds or under never split the bottom gears. It's just too much trouble. It's easier to go through the gears quicker. It's just as easy to, progressive shift without split. It's easier to progressive shift without splitting them. I'd love the 18-speed when we need it. But, you know, it's really just the 13-speed that we can split the bottom. The top end should be virtually identical. I think in your case, I might go with the 13 and save the $1,000 and a little bit of weight.
All right. And then with Pittsburgh Power, does Pittsburgh Power still deal with the micro blue trannies or no?
We can get it micro blued for you, yes.
I mean, it's just a mental thing for me. I mean, my 90-day average on the truck is 6.9, and that's through this last winter. I'm pretty good at driving the truck to be fuel efficient, and if I can get another 3 tenths or 5 tenths or whatever, you know, that'd be great. If not, who cares? I need a transmission anyway, and I have the money to buy
it. Do you have our manifold and turbo on that Caterpillar?
I do not. I have nothing on the nothing like that.
No, those two items right there are a half a mile of a gallon. The fast fuel system will give you another quarter to 3 tenths. So I wouldn't be looking at the transmission to make fuel mileage. I would be looking to improve the exhaust flow and the intake flow of the engine.
Right.
Transmission, you have to have a transmission. So.
Right. Right. So I noticed in the opening you talked about you had the setup to do transmissions at Pittsburgh Power now. My question is, what's the heaviest tractor that thing can pick up? Because my tractor weighs 29,500 pounds.
29,500. That's a pretty heavy tractor.
Yeah.
John, do you know what the capacity of our hoist is?
I think it was about 24. We do the math. It's 4,000 kg each, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Well,
that
sounds
25.
If I emptied all my tools out, emptied all the water out, I could probably get it down to maybe 26.
I think
we could pick that up. Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Well, we did transmissions without the lift, but it wasn't any fun. So it'll be a whole lot easier and quicker for us now.
Yeah.
Well, it really ain't going to be fun under this truck because, I mean, I run low rubber when I really should be running tall rubber. And, I mean, I have to squeeze in underneath the tractor through a tire.
Wow.
One of my fenders, you know. It's completely dressed.
We'll get it in the air somehow.
We'll get creative.
Okay, so I'll just put off Texas, and then I'll make arrangements to bring it to Pittsburgh Power, and then I guess maybe we can just take the 11 grand and talk about it.
Let's do that. I've got some...
There's been some warranty issues with the Micro Blue Triple S combination, and nobody wants to stand behind it. So we've gotten away from it, and we have a builder right there in Butler, Pennsylvania. I've been using him for 9 years. I have no problems with his rebuilds, and so I'm back to him, and I'm away from Triple S. Because when somebody builds something and they can't stand behind the warranty, then I can't be part of that.
Well, that's what I had heard, and that's why I wanted to call in when you was on to ask you about that, ask you guys about.
Well, now,
if you're interested, I've got a very good friend from the motorsports world who was a transmission engineer in Formula One. Actually, he's a fellow from England, and he builds transmissions for racing and some other interesting applications. And he's got some polishing processes that I would love to try on one of these transmissions for a big truck that in racing took a bunch of heat out of the transmissions and rear ends, which is just energy being spent. If you're making heat, you're burning fuel. So I don't know if you'd be interested or not. There would be no issues. It's not a coating that's going to come off. It is actually a polishing process that would have to do to all the gears, which means they'd have to be taken out of the transmission and sent away and polished and brought back. But it's something I've been dying to do on one of these, and you may be a candidate for that if you're interested.
I am interested because I need a new transmission. It's a no-brainer. And, I mean, I'm willing to try anything.
It doesn't
affect me, honestly. Kevin knows that.
That's right. Yeah, we like Steven. He can be a guinea pig.
Perfect.
All right.
Perfect.
Well, let's do this polishing process.
So I'll reach out
to... That sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
yeah,
reach out to me here.
Go ahead, John.
Go ahead. Well, Lee, the fellow who's interested in helping us out with this, is going to come to the Louisville Truck Show just to check out the industry he knows nothing about. And I told him I'd walk him around and introduce him to it and see what he thinks. But he's a pretty ingenious guy. He actually worked for the Jaguar Formula One team when he was in England. And he designed transmissions.
I would love to see that, see what kind of results. And John, I completely agree. You know this. Anytime we lower the heat in a component, we're saving energy. I mean, heat
right.
is lost energy. So we know in the drivetrain, we lower heat. That it's just the same as measuring a fuel economy gain.
Exactly. You've got to burn fuel to make that heat. So, you know, if
yeah.
automatic transmissions were actually efficient, they wouldn't need a cooler in front of your radiator. So that's,
that's right.
So, but
yeah.
We monitored all this stuff. We had data systems on everything. If we tried a new polishing process or a new geometry or a new whatever, we would have data logging systems on everything and would quantify what we did. So, you know, the team owner spent money to do something and would go test and would put temp sensors on that stuff and would do a long run and, you know, would sometimes go back to the old parts and do a control run just to see if we did have gains. So I've got a whole database of things in my head that worked for us in those situations that I'd love to try in this industry.
Yeah, well, I'll be right there waiting because I love that kind of stuff. So we'll keep talking about that. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's go to Texas. Eric, welcome to the program.
How you guys doing today?
Good.
What's on your mind?
Yes, a couple of weeks ago I redid my EGR cooler in my truck, and I took it to Redneck Diesel. That's the shop I use. I live in Houston. So I just go to Dallas. I use Redneck Diesel. And they said they do they could take all my emissions off my truck. And the guy there told me it cost me about $10,000. And I just want to know, is that worth it to take the emissions off the truck and just make a just straight engine? But the thing about it is he told me that in about 5 more years that my truck won't be able to be used as, you know, over the road truck. Is that true? And
well, I'll address that, and then I'll address the issue of the 5-year thing. You know, I like the guys down there, but anybody who says that they know that in 5 years you're not going to be able to do this or do that, or you're not going to be able to glide, or that's just not true. Nobody knows that. I stay on top of the regulations here. I'm going to put you back on hold because I was getting some feedback. I stay on top of the regulations, and there is nothing written anywhere that would say that. There's no time schedule. The federal government, I don't see them ever retroactively getting rid of trucks and saying you can't drive them anymore. That is just way too much of a burden on the industry. It puts people out of business. California's doing it, and look at the nightmare they've created, and they're being sued by everybody. So that's just, when somebody says in 5 years this truck isn't going to be legal anymore, it's pure speculation, and I think it's absolutely false. There's just no indication that the federal government is going to take trucks off the road. Their plan is keep making tougher and tougher standards on new trucks, and eventually they believe the old ones will go away. When I come back, guys, I'll let you address that call as well. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. It's the Power Hour. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. So, Bruce, John, Leroy, anything you guys want to address on that call?
Well, you know, we're not doing that. We're finding ways to work with the emissions on the engines. That way, a person can go into any truck dealership and not be harassed. So we're staying away from the deletes and not doing them. Second of all, he should never get on the air and mention his friend's name who's doing that, but that's my opinion right there.
Yeah, I'm not, again, fresh set of eyes for the industry here. I'm not a fan of it, seeing what some of these guys go through who come to us who've had this done to their truck that, you know, they might have a simple electrical issue and have been harassed by a dealership who won't work on their truck now.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be business for us, but it could cause you some major grief out there on the road.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, this has been kind of a progression because, you know, a couple of years ago we were saying that's the only way you're going to get fuel economy out of these trucks and performance and stop all the problems. And at the time, that was, you know, that was the available knowledge. But over the last several years, you guys have been working on ways to leave things in place and solve the problems, which is a much better solution. It's not as expensive. It's not as risky. You're not going to get harassed by the dealers. And, you know, I'll go back to that when he said this truck's going to be, you know, illegal in 5 years. It's illegal right now. I mean, if they want to crack down, that truck is no longer street legal once the emissions have been tampered with in a way that the EPA doesn't approve of. But I was addressing, is there going to be some widespread campaign to take these trucks off the road in 5 years? No, it doesn't make sense. They have the power to take the truck off the road right now if they want to.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's get to some more phone calls. Let's go to Denver. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? A question regarding the power box and the ECM tune. I've got an ISX 2010. International Pro Star. Had it in frame back in March. They put the larger pistons in there, so I've got the 550 horsepower package, but it's only tuned to 485. I'm billing about 40 psi on a hard pull, not consistently, but 36, 37, 38 consistently. My mechanic is telling me that I should not go to a higher horsepower because the transmission and the differential is not set up for it.
Well, let me say this about transmissions and differentials. Those specs all came out basically for company drivers that are hard on a throttle. Owner-operators, years ago, we were using 12.5, 13 speeds and running 700 horsepower in front of them and not having transmission and differential issues. The torque is the hardest on the drivetrain when you initially let out the clutch and roll into the throttle. And every time you see a guy taking off from a truck stop or from a toll booth or a traffic light, you know he doesn't own the truck. Owner-operators do not have driveline issues regardless of what their horsepower is. So if I were you, I'd set that up to 600 horsepower.
Okay. Okay. All right. Real good, then. I plan on coming out there to see you at some point, even though I do regional stuff around Colorado here. The other thing he told me was if I did go to the larger horsepower, that I would need the larger Cummins turbo for this instead of the stock.
No.
I think the variable geometry turbos are all the same. It's all in the programming of the ECM.
Okay. Okay, real good. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot, guys.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Wisconsin. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. Question on tuning the ECM. If you get that done when you take it in to get an overhead run or something at the cat shop, are they going to mess with it, change things back?
If you don't know who they are and tell them not to touch your ECM, yes, they will.
Okay. But every time you pull in there, they plug in a computer.
And then they feel they're obligated to put the latest and greatest settings in, which usually result in lower power and a loss of fuel mileage.
Okay. When you're down there at CMC this spring, Is there somebody there that can take it off and send it in for me?
Yes.
Okie doke.
Yeah, we could probably help you with that. In fact, Leroy will be there. Maybe we can just fix it right there to CMC for you.
Okay. What all do they do to it? Just change some parameters on it, or?
I'll let Leroy handle that one.
You said you'd be going to the CMC, correct?
Yes, sir.
Ethan will actually be at the CMC, but we both do about the same thing. And what engine do you have?
It's a C15.
Okay. There are a number of things that we do. It's more than just a few parameters on there. We're going to go down through a whole list of things. So.
But what okay. does he wants to know when he goes into Caterpillar and they give him another D rate, what is it that they're doing?
And there they have flash files that they get from the Caterpillar server, and they are obligated to update that every time that truck comes in if the software version that's in it is not what is on their server. So if it's older than what they have, then they're obligated to put the newer one in.
Even if you tell them not to?
Well, they are obligated to.
Okay. All right.
So when you want your overhead set, come to a shop like ours or another independent shop. Stay out of Caterpillar when you want your overhead set.
Okay. All righty. All right. Thank you kindly.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call.
Welcome.
Let's go to Idaho. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Great show. See, I had my ECM turned up by you guys just recently. I'm only on my first week of running it. And I'm just curious, what is the horsepower and torque on it? As, you know, I had it set to the 500 horse setting, but I was wondering what it is at the crank and at the wheels as far as torque and horsepower.
I can tell you. All right, Leroy, do you want to take that one?
You can go ahead, Bruce.
All right, 500 horsepower, so we divide it by 0.85 gives you, let me do a calculation here, 500. It gives you roughly 588 flywheel horsepower.
Okay.
And Leroy, what do we normally see on a dyno on increase in torque when you go up 88 horsepower? Do you see about 200 foot-pounds of torque?
Somewhere around there, yes.
So whatever your stock torque was, you should be up about 200 foot-pounds.
Okay. So you're saying I got 588 horse at the flywheel, so you're saying I got 500 at the wheel then?
That's correct. What are you making for turbo boost?
31, 32 on the mechanical gauge. The KR gauge is only shows 25.3.
That's certainly interesting.
Yeah, you might want to check in settings. You might want to toggle back and forth on the protocol setting. You have the 1708 and the 1939 or both. You have three options there. When we find one reading funny on boost, usually if you play around and just try either one of the other two settings, whatever you're not on, and see if that brings your boost back to the way it should be. Yours is off in a really odd way. There's another, some of the ECMs actually register boost in a whole different scale, but it doesn't sound like that's what yours is doing.
Mine is always, with the old setting, my boost at most would only go to 24.6, and now just with this new program and stuff, it goes up to, most of the time it only goes to 24.3, but if I'm in the mountain or whatever pulling, it'll go, the highest I've seen is 25.3.
That's on the scan gauge, and on the mechanical you're seeing 31, right?
Yeah, right around 31, 32, somewhere right around there.
Okay. Did you send us the ECM? Or did you bring the truck in?
No, I send it to you. I have my the order number. I know it by heart, you know, 59904.
But my question is I would like to see that truck because you're still down a little bit on horsepower.
Okay.
Is it possible to get that truck to our shop?
Yeah, I'll just have to get a load out that way.
Yeah.
And then how much time in advance do I have to get you, you know?
If you could give us 3 days, that would be wonderful.
Okay.
But I think you have an electrical issue, something between the ECM and the boost sensor.
Okay. What? I'm wondering if the boost sensor itself is, you know, I got it's a 2000 Freightliner, but I have the DDEC 3 1994 in it, and I have no history on the engine, so I just keep replacing stuff. I rebuilt it.
Yeah.
I blew it up on Halloween, and I had it rebuilt and stuff, but that didn't change any of the other stuff.
Take the boost sensor out and clean it with some brake clean and put it back in, and you should be upwards to around, let me give you a figure here.
And I was wondering what the torque would be at the wheels and the crank.
All right, guys. Well, while we're working out some numbers, the music's playing. I've got to get to a break. We're going to come back right after this. We'll get to as many calls and questions as we can in this final segment. So don't go away. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up here. We're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour, so we're going to get to as many questions as we can. At the end, I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. But don't go away because we're going to come right back and we're going to do another hour of general questions. So here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. It is the Power Hour. Joining me, Bruce, John, and Leroy from Pittsburgh Power. Before the break, we were talking with Gary in Idaho. So, Bruce, do you have some numbers for him?
Yes, he should be making 35 pounds of turbo boost. So we need to get that truck in the shop and find out what else is wrong with it and why it's not developing the power it should be.
Okay. Been the best thing. I used to like my truck. Now I love it. You know, since I had that ECM turned up, I mean, it's made a huge difference. My exhaust actual pipe is actually cleaner now than what it was before, and I thought it was burning pretty efficient then.
One of the problems that I think that you have going on right now is why one reads different than the other is you have a DDEC 4 ECM on there, most likely on a DDEC 3 engine, correct?
Correct.
Okay. The hardware inside the ECM is going to read different between a DDEC 4 and 3. So if you put a DDEC 3 sensor on DDEC 4 controls, the A to D conversion for that boost sensor number is going to be different, and that's why it only goes up to 25 instead of what you're actually making. So it's just a simple fact that we need to see the ECM again and make the changes for a DDEC 3 boost sensor. So it's merely just interpreting the sensor wrong. Not that you're actually only making 25 or there's anything wrong with the boost sensor. It's just interpreting it wrong.
Got it. Let's get to some more calls. Let's go to Colorado. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. How are you today? Appreciate you taking
my
call. Hey, first, quick questions. I know you've got a long line. Bruce, you guys, John, you might remember me. I was the guy who had an 11-1 Detroit in your shop and give
remember
you a plug
you
out. You, great job. I'm getting my best fuel mileages. I'm only 9,000 miles in, but it's been really good so far. My question is, I'm all in on this truck now. It's a rebuilder. It's a work in progress. But I've got one differential, the rear differential, that's got to be replaced soon. I've replaced the front differential a few years ago, but it's got 373s, I think. But I'm kicking around the idea of just starting to go all in and put 264s or 279s, and then maybe getting a 13-speed and throwing it in there as well. But I was concerned about the startability with an 11-1 Detroit. The torque's still kind of low, you know, when it's down there in the lower ranges. And I'm wondering what your opinions are on that and what you think, you know, whether I should just stay with what I got, the 10-speed, and just throw another differential in, or go ahead and put some 264s in there. And if you remember, I haul nothing but light, like 90% of my freight.
Light.
Yeah, so just wondering what your opinion is on that.
What speed do you drive?
60, realistically 60, yeah. I'd like to bring it down to 55 to 57 a little bit more. But with the 10-speed, I'm then kicking it up to 1620 RPM, so I generally run 60 unless I'm in a headwind. And then I bring it down to 58.
Kevin, I know you've done some research on the 279s, and being it's an 11.1 liter, I'm thinking maybe the 279, I'd definitely go to a 13-speed. You know, everyone knows my feeling on 10-speeds. I don't like them.
Yeah, here's what I do,
Kevin.
But, I'm kind of changing my tune a little bit on this right now just because of fuel price being so low. But in the perfect world, the way I would set this up with the 11.1 is I would actually go to 293s. This 11.1 will run at a higher RPM than the 12.7. So the 13-speed and 293s would be ideal. But, you know, that's a $10,000 modification. By the time you do a 13-speed in gears, you're very close to $10,000. And at today's fuel price, there's just not a big enough return. And I would much rather see you take the $10,000 and buy all the other goodies that give us a much quicker ROI. And then, you know, keep it on the list. If fuel ever goes back to $4 or $5 a gallon, and it will, or you need one of these components because it's failing or we're predicting it's going to fail, then 13-speed and 293s would be ideal.
Okay, yeah, that I've already considered all that, and I'm pretty loaded down on the goodies.
The air tabs,
fleet air filter.
Yeah.
Got the manifold put in 9,000 miles ago, crankshaft dampener, fast, you name it, I got it. Other than side skirts for my tanks.
Then,
and I do need.
It's a matter
I've got a million.
When?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's a matter of when you feel like you need it, but if you're going to replace them, I think the ideal setup would be a 13-speed and 293s.
Okay, and the real question, though, was, and I guess I never really said it, was startability. When I do have that 10% of the time, I'm taking a heavy load, and living in Colorado, it's 80,000 pounds of potatoes and 80,000 pounds of groceries coming back. I don't know what the startability would be like with a like a 293 on 11.1.
You'll feel it a little. You're going to have to work a little harder, and this isn't a setup. It kind of goes back to what Bruce said earlier about all the parameters that they give us on torque and, you know, what the transmission and the differentials can handle. I wouldn't give this setup to an inexperienced driver, but somebody who owns the truck and is going to take care of it and realizes that when you're heavy, you're going to work a little harder just to get it rolling. You're going to work the clutch a little bit more, but I don't think there's any either short or long-term consequences. I mean, I've worked with setups like this. You could make it work with the 279s. I just think the 293s will give you a little better startability, which I'm not all that concerned about anyway, and will give you a better RPM up on the top end for that 11.1.
All right. Well, hey, I'll be getting it back out there, you guys. I appreciate you taking my call.
Are you in a position you can write down a phone number?
About 2 seconds to grab a pen.
Hey, Matt, let me give you a call this afternoon. You got your phone, the number we have here on file?
Well, I might be busy, I can call you back. I got some plans. I should hear the phone. But, yep, give me a call.
Okay.
All right, John.
All right, sounds good. Let's see if we can squeeze another one in here. Let's go to Iowa. Gene, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What's on your mind?
I'm looking at a truck that has an M11 Cummins in it. I was just wondering what your opinions are on that motor.
Where? What part of the country do you normally run?
Well, if I buy this truck, I'll be running Central Florida for 8 months of the year, and in the Southeast region for the other 4 months.
And how much gross weight?
Be pulling a grain hopper, so it'll be 80,000 pounds one way and empty the other.
Well, and I don't have a lot of experience with the M11, but I've certainly followed some down the highway and talked to the driver, and they seem to do okay. And if you're in Florida and you're empty one way, it'll probably work.
Yeah,
I'll jump in there. I did a lot of research on the M11 because I ran Florida and the Southeast. That's why I was seeking out the 11-liter engines, and I loved the 11-liter Detroit. When they stopped making that available, I was going to switch to the M11. The research that I did on it was even in that part of the country, the engine was okay. It just didn't have a very long life. Most of them looked like they were being in-framed around 700,000 or 800,000 instead of like 1.2 on my 11-liter Detroits. And nobody was really getting any fuel economy out of them, which was my whole point in going with the 11-liter because I was squeezing more fuel economy out of it. But that engine seemed to be like stuck at about 6.5, and there wasn't a lot we could do with it to get it better. So unless there's some really special reason why you want a particular truck, there are so many trucks that, you know, you could get with a 12.7 or, you know, even the 12-liter Cat. Unless there's something really special about this truck, it wouldn't excite me.
Oh, well, that's why I was calling to get opinions on that particular engine and, you know, some insight. It's in a 96 Volvo, and I like the 96 Volvos, but there are plenty of them out there, and, you know, I could find one with an N14 or a 12.7 just as easy.
I would take the either one of those two engines hands down over the M11. If I could get one with an N14 or a 12.7 Detroit, I'd be all over it. Hey, guys, we ran right into the music again. If you have any more questions for Pittsburgh Power, give them a call or look them up on the website or both. So, Bruce, John, Leroy, we're all out of time. Thanks, you guys, for joining me and helping out, and we will do it again next week. In the meantime, be safe, be profitable, be responsible, and master the journey. Kevin Rutherford. Good night, everyone. All right, everybody, we're going to get to a second hour. Let me run through real quick and see what we've got for questions. Looks like we're doing pretty good right now. If you press 1 on your phone, you might have a shot of getting through, and I'll keep you updated as we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. In fact, if you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call, we'll get to it. Couple things, and then we're going to get right to your calls and questions. We are running out of time for a couple things. If you've been thinking about these things, if you've been procrastinating about these things, if you haven't done them, get to it. Let me go through what they are. Taxes, number one. We are quickly running out of time to get a good quality tax return done without filing an extension. You may not think we're there yet, but we absolutely are. Tax firms, people who prepare taxes, are swamped right now, and it gets worse every single day. That means the odds of you getting real good one-on-one attention go down every day. The odds that you're going to run out of time and end up filing an extension go up every day. And keep in mind, when you file an extension, that is not an extension of time to pay. It's only an extension of time to file. The day after that tax return is due on April 15th, you will be charged interest and penalties every day you wait, even if you file the extension. And if you don't get your stuff into a tax preparer soon, the odds are you're going to get an extension. Or you're using somebody who can get it done quickly but probably won't get it done right. So get it done. Get to that right now. Along with that, if you don't have an accounting system, if you are throwing your receipts in a bag and waiting until the end of the year, and that's why you've been putting this off, because you don't want to sit down and try to tackle a year's worth of accounting, then get an accounting system in place right now. It should have been in place in January. We're in March. Get it done. That way next year you won't have all this stress. And I can tell you the single biggest thing you can do to get your tax return, the amount of tax you're going to pay down, is to have a good accounting system. The second thing is to have a tax who understands accounting. If you do those two things alone, you'll save thousands of dollars on taxes and you'll lower your stress level. Stress is really bad for you. Anything you can do to lower stress is a good thing. So get your taxes taken care of, number one. Get your accounting taken care of, number two. If you need any help with any of those things at all, no matter what your situation is, company driver, owner operator, fleet owner, you name it, sole proprietor, partnership, corporation, LLC, whether you have employees, doesn't matter. We have a tax program and an accounting program to help you. So call us, 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3835. Also, it's time to get registered for the CMC. It's getting really close. May 16th through the 20th, it is going to be our best CMC ever, our biggest, baddest, best CMC. We're 10 years plus now on this program, and I am so excited about this year. We have an amazing lineup of speakers, best-selling authors, industry experts. People have been doing this. Your lineup alone, there's 100-plus years worth of trucking experience, really knowledgeable trucking experience, and you're going to be surrounded by 300 and more, over 300 like-minded owner-operators and business owners for an entire week. It is just full immersion. You will learn more. One of my favorite quotes from somebody who came to the event more than once, he said, I have been an owner-operator for 41 years. And he said, I learned more during the week of the CMC. Actually, the first time he went, it was only a two-day program. And he said, I learned more in 2 days about really running this business profitably than I learned in 41 years. And then in the five-day program, we just take it right over the top. So there's way too much for me to talk about here. You can go to the website and get some idea of what's going on there. You can call us. We'll answer all your questions. I can't make this any easier. We keep the price very, very reasonable. I've been to five-day business conferences that cost $10,000. That's not unusual. Ours is $1,500, and we're feeding you 90% of the week. We cover breakfast, we cover lunch, we cover snacks and breaks, and we cover several of the dinners. So get signed up. Not only is it just $1,500, but I'll finance it for you. I want to make sure you can come to this event. It'll only cost you about $100 or so to get your seat locked in and join us in Council Bluffs this year. I can't wait to be there, and I can't wait to see you there. Come join us. Same number, 855-800-3835. Same website, letstruck.com. Look under the events tab, and we will see you in Council Bluffs. Let's head off to some phone calls. Let's go to Minnesota. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. You make all these suggestions on Audible, and one thing I just wanted to get across to everybody is your first book is free when you sign up for it.
You can't beat free.
No, you can't. And there's no excuse for getting your first book if it's free. You just download it, go online, sign up, and download your first book. But my other question was, what are you doing at MAPS this year?
Okay, so I'll give you a sneak peek because this hasn't been completely confirmed yet, but I think we're safe enough. And so we are not doing a seminar this year. I'm a little frustrated with show management. We've gone backwards on education at this show. I used to do, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I used to do a 3 to 5 hour seminar at MATS. People loved it. We packed the room. It was free. We got our sponsors to pay for everything. We got them to cater lunch. We had gifts. It was just a great event. And over the years, they've just made it more and more difficult. They make us book the seminar room in 1 hour segments. And the way they do it, you don't even get 40 minutes because of the setup time. Plus, I'm a stickler for when I do a seminar, I am usually in there 3 and 4 hours ahead of time, setting up audio, setting up video, testing and retesting, getting the lighting right. You know, and we don't get that. We have to walk in at the top of the hour when one seminar is just finishing, and we have to go blind, trying to set up equipment and mics. And we fought against that for a couple of years. And until we can get some sort of a change where we can book a 3 to 5 hour window, be able to be in our room and get it set up ahead of time, it's just not worth it to try to do a seminar under those conditions. So unfortunately, we won't be doing a business seminar like we've done in the past. I will be hanging out and wandering around with all of our partner companies. And the one thing I haven't completely confirmed yet, I have been invited to moderate a panel on the new oil specifications by Chevron. And I've agreed to do it. We're just negotiating the final details on that right now. So, for those of you who don't know, we go through new oil specifications every so many years, usually because of new engine technology. And the next specification is about to be rolled out, so they're working out all the details on it. So we will be doing a panel. We'll have a bunch of oil experts up there to answer all the questions. I'll be moderating the panel. So that's on Thursday. Other than that, I'm not sure yet. I need to check with Sirius and see if there's any broadcast time that they're going to want me to come over and join in on. That's always fun. I like joining Chris and Meredith during the day when they're broadcasting, so we'll see if we can do that again. So that's the rundown on what's going on for Mats this year. There's the music. That means I've got to get to a break. John, when we get back from the break, I'll jump back on there and see if that answered your question. Then we'll get to more of your calls and questions. So stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. John, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping there was going to be more going on at Mats this year with all the OEMs pulling out, but that answers my question.
Yeah, you know, we had thought about approaching show management because they had the OEMs pulling out and, you know, trying to negotiate a better deal on a seminar, more time, a space. And you know, we've struggled with it in the past, and we had so much going on ourselves this year between tax season, our big CMC coming up, and so we'll see what we can negotiate going forward. I would love to get back to doing bigger, longer, free seminars at the truck shows, but we've got to get some cooperation from show management on that. Let's go to Minnesota. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I want to thank you for all of your hard work, and especially the profit.
You're welcome.
So I've got a full year in my profit gauges, and I'm hoping that you can look at my business report.
I have got your business report up here in front of me, and tell me what your secret is.
Haul something dangerous.
Okay. I knew there had to be something going on here.
I haul fuel.
Okay. All
but,
right. Most fuel hauling is pretty local. Is that what yours is?
Yeah, primarily.
Okay. The numbers look fantastic. I mean, in a lot of ways. So, great profit. We're going to go over the numbers specifically, but great profit per mile, and low miles. So this is one of those operations that I loved. I used to do a lot of local P&D work, short regional haul, that kind of stuff. I like LTL. I like that challenging, you know, keep you busy. Time management's important. I like those kind of operations, and you're certainly making it work for you. So let's go over some of the numbers here. Less than 59,000 miles for the year. That's what most people would consider part-time as far as miles go. But when you run local, the hours can add up as well. But that's nice because our equipment lasts a lot longer. You know, our maintenance cost, even if our maintenance cost per mile isn't really low, our maintenance cost will be lower because we're just not putting on that many miles. So that's a great number to start with. 58,000 miles, $1.97 a mile for all miles, gross revenue. Fuel's at 36 cents. Not going to get too excited about that because there's plenty of revenue here and it is local and it's heavy when you're loaded. So we could always look at that, but I'm not too excited. Maintenance cost per mile, 13 cents. But your maintenance cost for the whole year, this is what I was talking about, it's less than $8,000. I mean, that's nothing on the revenue we had. And your fixed costs are pretty low. We've only got 20 cents in total fixed cost. So you're keeping $1.23 a mile. That is absolutely fantastic. It's 63% of your revenue you are keeping as net income. And on, like I said, 58,000 miles, you took home $72,000. That's pretty hard to beat.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't, I'm really impressed with your profit gauges.
Well, thank you.
I feel like I have all the tools now I need to be in business, whereas before I didn't have these numbers to look at.
It really is. It's amazing in a lot of ways. One, I just love the feeling of looking at the numbers and seeing how profitable you are. I mean, you've done an amazing job. Two, we can look at them and attempt to improve them because every time we improve one of these numbers, it means we have more money in our pocket. And three, we can monitor to make sure something doesn't go wrong. You know, if we're at $1.23 a mile and, you know, we look at, like right now, when you finish the first quarter, I tend to look at things in, you know, monthly, but then I also look in quarterly chunks. And so January, February, when March is over, you know, and you look at your numbers, we would be comparing it to that $1.23. Did you improve? Did you stay about the same? Did things get worse? And no matter what happens, you'll be able to see why. If you got better, you'll be able to say, oh, look, my revenue per mile went up. Or, you know, I worked on my fuel economy and now my fuel cost went down. If they got worse, you'll be able to pinpoint the problem and then go work on it. So it really is an essential tool. We love profit gauges. I have a lot of years invested into building this program, and it's just wonderful to see people like you using it the way it was meant to be used.
Yeah, the other thing I'd like to say to encourage people out there is the truck that I bought cost $16,500.
Wow, I absolutely love that. So we have guys who are in lease purchase programs, and they are ecstatic to be making 40 cents a mile. And, you know, and their justification is, well, before I did this, I was making 35 cents a mile. What they don't realize is all the risk they're taking, all the additional taxes they're going to pay, all the other costs. And yet here you are with a $16,000 truck making well over a dollar per mile net. That is fantastic.
All right. Well, thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you. I'd love seeing those kind of reports. I'd love seeing people use that tool the way it was meant to be used. And I love seeing people succeed. You know, when I hear there's just no money in trucking or why would you ever want to be an owner-operator, this is why. This is exactly why. For opportunities like this, for opportunities to run 58,000 miles and take home $72,000 and be home pretty regularly. Love that. Let's go to Jacob in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program.
I had a few questions about Annie Gel. I kind of know it's out of season, but what is the right temperature to use Annie Gel?
What year is your truck?
It's 14.
Okay. one of the things that have happened over the years is all the systems on the truck, I shouldn't say all the systems, if we ignore the emissions, most other things about trucks have gotten so much better. Cold weather doesn't affect our trucks nearly as bad as it used to. You know, the guys who have been around a while remember back when cabs weren't insulated very well, and I can remember if temperatures got too cold, I was driving in a snowmobile suit and boots just to stay warm. We were putting winter fronts and cardboard in front of the radiator. You still couldn't get any heat out of the truck. Fuel lines would gel up constantly, filters. You don't see that as much anymore. Things are much better insulated, much better engineered. So we don't see as many cold weather problems unless it's related to the emission systems. You may have to deal with that. My general rule of thumb, and some of this you just get used to what your truck is going to do because every truck's different. My general rule of thumb is if it's going to be below 10 degrees for a significant amount of time, I don't mean a couple hours early in the morning. I mean, if we're going to have one of those cold snaps that we're going to be below 10 degrees for a couple days, then I'll put in a good winter fuel conditioner. If it's below zero, even for a couple hours, I'll probably, you know, look ahead and dump some in as well. But the one thing that people make a mistake with, this is not one of those things where if a little bit is good, a lot is better. It is the exact opposite. If you put in too much of a fuel conditioner, you will create the same problems as not having any, and you'll create some new problems. So when you use a good winter fuel conditioner, dose it the way the bottle says. Don't think, well, you know, I only need a half a bottle, but I already opened it, so I might as well just dump the whole bottle in and it'll work better. Don't do that. It won't work better. Dose it the way they recommend. And many of them will give you two levels. You know, if you need a little bit of help, use this level. If it's extreme, use this level. So just use some logic. You know, if it's 8 degrees outside, you probably get away with the lower level. If it's minus 40 out, yeah, then we're going to use the maximum that they recommend, but not any more than that, because it won't do better if you use more. So let me get to a break. We'll come back, and Jacob, I'll make sure that answered your question, and then we'll get to more of your calls. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. The website is letstruck.com. I go back to Pennsylvania. Jacob, did that help?
Yes, sir. I did have a follow-up question. My company told me they didn't want me to use any anti-gel, as they said it would mess up the fuel systems on our truck. I'm not really wanting to believe that. Is there any truth to what they're saying?
You know, what they're probably afraid of is not having control over the type and the amount. And I think they've probably experienced what I just talked about, thinking, I already opened the bottle. I know if I pour the whole thing in, it's three times more than what they recommend, but that'll make it work better. And then it starts causing problems. That's probably what they've experienced. And
okay.
Not every fuel additive on the market is worth anything. Some of them are just junk. So, you know, I think the carrier probably figures they'll have less problems overall if they just prohibit the use of additives at all, then trying to control what gets used and how much, I kind of agree with them. If I had a whole bunch of drivers out running a whole bunch of trucks, I think that they're right. Just avoiding them completely would result in fewer problems. Now, every once in a while, you're going to have a truck not start. You're going to have a filter gel and clog. It's going to happen, but I actually think that's an easier problem to deal with than drivers running around dumping all kinds of stuff in the tank and nobody controlling it.
Yeah, I've been a little gun shy since I was just a regular lease operator, and I froze up and I had to wait 2 days on a tow, and the tow cost me $1,700, and just getting unfrozen at the dealership cost me about $700. So I've been gun shy ever since.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of the challenges that fleets always face. You know, the owner-operator, especially the good owner-operator who wants to learn this stuff, has so much more control over the truck and breakdowns and expenses. And the fleets, this is one of the biggest problems they face. You know, there are solutions, there are things they could do better, but it's very difficult to do that with drivers running around wild all over the place.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your answer there, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's see. Let's head off to Pennsylvania. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. My question, I have the tire pressure monitor system by TST, and I need to know if there is a direct correlation with ambient temperature and the cold tire pressure that we should be running.
There is, but the answer is really simple. This is one of those things that we don't have to try to overthink. That's why we use the term cold tire pressure, and we always state tire pressure cold, meaning we're not driving the tire. We're not talking about whether it's cold or hot outside. We would consider it cold tire pressure if you were sitting in Death Valley in the morning and it was 110 degrees outside, but you hadn't driven the truck in, let's say, 4 hours at least, certainly overnight. Even though it's 110 degrees outside, if you haven't driven the truck, we would consider that cold tire pressure. We would also consider it cold tire pressure if you're in northern Minnesota and it's minus 20 out. It's still cold tire pressure. What we should probably use a different word instead of referring to temperature, but the good news is we don't adjust for that. If you're checking your tire pressure and that's the ambient air temperature, and let's say that you have a steer tire that you determined should be kept at 110 pounds. If it's minus 20 out and you're going to check your air pressure, bring it to 110 pounds. If it's 110 degrees outside and you're checking your tire pressure, set it to 110 pounds. We don't have to make any adjustments. The reason for that is, I'm not going to say it's impossible and it doesn't happen, but it's pretty rare that you're ever going to start out at minus 20 and end up at 100 degrees, I mean. Yes, the temperature is going to change throughout the day, but it's not going to cause any problems. So, you know, and I've been over this many, many times with Mike Beckett. He believes the same way, that, you know, 95%+ of the time, we don't have to think about the outside temperature and try to make some sort of adjustment. Start the day off with your tire pressure. Check them in the morning before you move the truck. That's when you set your tire pressure. It'll be fine that day no matter what happens. Does that make sense?
That's what I need. Absolutely. Right on the money. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You're welcome. See, let's head off to California. Donald, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. How you doing today? I understand.
Doing good. What can I help you with?
I've got I've ordered your book. I got it a few last week, and my CD8 number 3. So I've got to get it out so I can listen to this more. But I wanted to find out a bit more information. I've been doing a lot of research, and I'm just torn about. I live in California. I want to get a newer truck because I figure I have less trouble with the truck. And I do the engine.
Well, wait,
but I was looking at
stop right there. Stop right there. I want to dispel that myth. Not only do we see more engine problems with new trucks, we absolutely know we see more engine problems. But the problems go way beyond that. And I'll explain why. First off, the engine emissions really only include like the EGR, EGR coolers, those kind of things. The after treatment systems cause problems. The DPFs, that's not really part of the engine. That's causing all kinds of problems. The SCR systems, not really part of the engine, causing all kinds of problems. But we also see that these trucks now have 3 to 4 times more electronic sensors than pre-emission trucks. And those sensors are an absolute nightmare. They are constantly setting off what the truck manufacturer calls the check engine light, what, you know, we refer to around here, thanks to Dale Howard, is the throw money at the dealer light. The sensor has a blip. Yeah, the sensor has a blip. It derates the engine, the light's on, and we have to go throw money at the dealer, and they throw parts at the truck, and we do this dance over and over and over. Because the electrical systems are much more complicated, more wiring, more sensors, more computers, we see far more problems with electrical systems than we ever used to. So true that these trucks are more reliable. Not even the rest of the truck itself is more reliable. So, you know, if you wanted that, if you wanted that newer truck feel so that some things aren't worn out, so that they're newer, your best bet is a glider because you get the new truck stuff and you get to keep the old engine technology. We're not going to have all those sensors. We're not going to have all that wiring. We're not going to have all of those problems. So, and we can make a glider California compliant. So your first reason for wanting a new truck isn't valid.
Okay. So where can I – okay, I want to – I have about 75 grand that I want to put down in a truck. Where can I find the glider?
Why put it down? Why – Snyder right now has some great 2012 gliders in the $50,000 or $60,000 range, which means you could walk in, pay cash for the truck, have no payment, no finance charges, and still probably have enough left over to retrofit it with a DPF and pay cash for that.
I'd like to get like a 485. Your Snyders are running around 4.25, 450 horsepower. I'd like to get at least a 485 plus with a 13-speed in 336 gears or in that area over the road.
Hold on. Well, there's the music. Let me get to a break, and I'll come back, and we'll just tweak your thinking a little bit. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Ruff. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get back to Donald in California. So, Donald, are you ready for a little thinking adjustment?
I am. Fill up
okay,
my funky brain.
Good. So you were focusing on a decision that once you made it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to change or fix, and that's buying a new truck. Once you buy it, you're stuck. It does have emissions. It does have all these sensors. It does have a higher maintenance cost. It is more likely to break down and leave you on the side of the road. And that's, you can't change any of those things. And the only thing you can do, which is pretty drastic, is to get rid of it, and you'll get killed. I mean, you lose so much money that it's, I mean, it can put you out of business. On the other hand, you're worrying too much about things that are easy to change. For example, if we go buy a used Schneider glider or any used glider or an older pre-emission truck, either one, and we don't like the horsepower setting because it's 450 or whatever it might be, hour or less to turn that up to 700 horse if we want it. And it's not even that expensive. I mean, there is so much we can do with the engines, especially the pre-emission engines, as far as, you know, ECM tuning, throwing a power box on it. We can create more horsepower and torque than we know what to do with. That's easy. Even gears.
Okay.
Let's say the truck just has just gears that just aren't going to work for us at all. So what? It's a day and $4,000, and we have a whole new set of gears. So those things are easy to change. So those things do not get put high up on my priority list. They're on my list. I mean, when you go through the whole book, and maybe you've already been there, I go through how to design the perfect truck, right down to every single little detail. But I also say the odds of finding that truck after you design it are slim to none. But we put those, you know, I help you put those specs in order of what's really important. Like the first three or four things, we're just not going to compromise on, you know, because you can't change them. You know, I want the right engine, because we can't really change that after the fact. So I want an aerodynamic truck, because I can't really change that after the fact.
Right.
Those are
right.
Things I'm not going to compromise on. Gear ratio. Yeah, I'd love to find the truck with the exact gear ratio that I've figured out is going to work for me and my operation. But if I can't, I'll compromise on that because I can change it. I mean, it just becomes part of the budget. You know, we just know, okay, we're going to buy this truck and it's going to cost us an extra $4,000 because we're going to change gears. Although in today's world, with $2 fuel, I'll buy the truck with the wrong gears, just leave them alone.
Yes.
If fuel goes back up, then I might change it. But the little bit of fuel mileage difference because of the wrong gears in today's world is not that big of a deal. So
I agree.
Let's start to refocus on the really important things about the truck that we can't change after the fact. And let's not sweat the stuff that we can change, because we can just create a plan to change it. That makes sense?
Okay. Yes. I'm looking at Peterbilt or Kenworth, and that's, again, I want the aerodynamics, but I'm not dead set on it. You know, I just, I like running 11 Western in the mountains and climate. I love the challenges, something with some horsepower, but again, is Peterbilt kind of
line? I'm assuming this is your first truck.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go back to what's really important about this first truck. If we had to prioritize what's the most important fact about you going into business right now, I'll give you my answer and then you tell me if you agree with this. The most important factor for you going into business is that you stay in business.
Correct.
Is that true? So we should be making our decisions primarily focused on the decisions that will help you stay in business. I like PACCAR products as well. Very high quality, hard to go wrong, but you're not going, the odds of you finding a used PACCAR glider, pretty slim. You might, they're out there, but there are thousands more Freightliner gliders available. So this might be one of those times where we say, boy, I'd really love to have a Peterbilt or a Kenworth, and I get that, but the more important factor right now is that I just stay in business. So let's buy a Freightliner. After a year or two, we're in business, we've got numbers, we know we're doing good, you can go trade off a truck. If you buy it smart, get a year or two out of it, you're not going to lose any money. And then you move up to the truck you really, really want. But don't do that in the beginning because you're risking, it's going to cost you more. If you find one, great. But if you don't say, well, I really wanted a PACCAR product, so I'm going to go buy a 2010 PACCAR and I'll deal with all the emissions. Don't do that. If all you can find in a pre-emission or a glider is a Freightliner, then buy that. Get through your first year to build a good foundation, and then you can go buy the truck you really want.
Is there a year I should stay around or under or like a?
Well, I don't care. I don't care about the truck year itself because gliders could be any year. What we care about is the engine, and we do not want an engine manufactured after 2003.
Well, I appreciate your information, and I'm looking
You're
forward
welcome.
To reading more of your book. Looking forward to May too. I want to go to your class.
Fantastic! Love to see you there. That's the kind of stuff we do right there in lane one. We readjust thinking. We readjust priorities. We're actually going to sit down and write business plans. We're going to set goals. We're going to set budgets. We're going to set up accounting systems. And you're going to have me all week long to answer your questions and help you write this plan. If you do what you're doing right now, which is going through all three steps of the program, 1, 2, and 3, you will be guaranteed to succeed. You will come out of there with a better business plan than 99% of the owner-operators who have ever come before you. Let's go to New York. Alan, welcome to the program.
How are you doing today, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with?
They should have sent over my business report. I'd like you to take a look at that.
I've got it here. Tell me if these dates are right. May through December, is that what we're looking at for 2015?
Yeah. The actual operation time is closer to 6 months than it is to actual May. There's some downtime with the truck, and I actually went on vacation and stuff. So it's closer to about six
got
months.
It.
For those figures.
Okay. Did you start it in the middle of the year? Start
yes,
in business
I did.
In the middle of the year? Okay.
Yep,
and the reason I asked that is because, the first year is always tough. You know, like I was telling the last caller, the first goal is just to survive. Hell, I don't think we're super profitable. I just want to get somebody through that first year and make sure they're still in business. Your numbers, though, are way beyond that. I mean, your numbers are well into really good profit territory. So let's go through some of the numbers here. $1.68 a mile on all miles. You know, in 2015,
and
was a great number.
That's absolutely every single mile. I mean, I bobtail. I drop my trailers and stuff in Rochester, New York. That's where we load out of. And I live 65 miles away. So there's 130 miles round trip every time I do that. And sometimes that's twice a week.
Yeah, that
absolutely
adds up. So that tells us that your paid miles are really good. But this is the one we want to see. We want to see all those miles because when you're driving that truck, it's costing you money. So $1.68 a mile. Your fixed costs are pretty good, 28 cents a mile. Nothing to get worried about there. Fuel cost is a little concerning. Why is your fuel cost so high?
I had issues with the truck. I was barely getting 5, and I'm up right now. I'm averaging 6.2 miles per gallon.
Okay, good. That's a big improvement then.
Yeah, and I've done a lot of modifications. I was a guy that called in and talked to you and the guys from Pittsburgh Power. I've got the Western Star that I put the resistor in place to shut the EGR off. And that's where I gained my mileage at. When that shut down, and I mean, and I've got the fast system.
The music's playing, so I'm going to have to cut you loose. The good news is you're netting 66 cents a mile. For your first 6 months, that is fantastic. And there's 20 cents a mile to be saved in fuel cost alone. Get rid of the resistor. Get that thing tuned the way it should be. Do a couple more modifications, and that 66 is going to turn into north of 80 cents a mile. That's outstanding. Keep up the hard work, and we will see you back here next time. Check out the website at letstruck.com. Be safe, be profitable, be responsible, and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks, and we'll see you back here tomorrow for an hour of Destination Health and general questions. See you then.